As this short talk is to be for an Australian broadcast, I must be allowed to begin by sending warm greetings to a country which treated me so well during the 23 years that I spent there. I can never forget the hospitality of Australia itself and of its people, and in particular, I think always with gratitude of the kindness of my Adelaide friends. I have been asked to say something to you of modern scientific discoveries. These have been plentiful enough in recent years, and amazing, and unexpected. It is natural that those which are concerned with the extreme in dimensions should first attract attention. We all like to hear of the very large or the very small. Children love stories of giants or fairies. When Swift in Gulliver's Travels shot his venomed arrows against the objects of his denunciation, they were feathered with the same idea of extreme size, ranging from Brobdignag to Lilliput. Physical astronomy has reached out into the immense distances of space to regions from which light must travel for millions of years before it brings us the news of what is going on there. Einstein and Jeans and Eddington and others treat the stars as laboratories, in which indeed the happenings are beyond their control, but they can watch what goes on there and observe the consequences of temperatures and disturbances far exceeding the limits that are set in our laboratories on the Earth. At the other extreme, Lord Rutherford and his fellow workers penetrate into the interior of the nucleus of the atom. The nucleus is the central feature of the atom, as the sun is of the solar system. And the relative dimensions of the system and its sun are about the same as those of the atom and its nucleus. This is certainly remarkable when it is considered that 100 millions of atoms in a row cover only an inch or so. They shatter the nucleus and form new atoms, thus realizing the dream of the alchemist. But it is to be remembered that the cost of doing this is tremendous. There's not the slightest foundation for the idea that in these ways any lucrative finance is in sight. Between these extremes of the very great and the very small, many striking discoveries have been made recently. In these few minutes, I propose to speak of one that comes nearer home to us all, and in particular may interest Australians, since it has to do with all classes of fibre, such as wool or hair. We all know that fibres are spun into a thread which holds together if a twist is given to the fibres as they are put together. The fibres hold on to one another because each one is provided with minute excrescences along its sides, and the strength of the thread depends upon the extent to which these fibres interlock. The quality of a wool depends in part upon this capacity for interlocking. The object of the spinning or twisting is to force the fibres into contact side by side, and indeed so that the more stress is put on the fibre, the more are the fibres pressed together. When a thread is broken, the interlocking fails, and the fibres are drawn past one another. For good weaving, the length of the fibre is also important. Sometimes old materials are torn asunder and re-spun and rewoven, but the cloth so made is never so good as the original because the fibres are shorter and their excrescences are worn. The technical name for this second-rate material is shoddy, and the word has passed usefully into our everyday language. All this is an old story. It's a new discovery that nature spins and weaves in ways that have never entered into our thoughts, because she works on a scale so fine that no eyes can or will ever see her at work. Not even the microscope can help us. Our new knowledge is gained from the use of the X-rays. Each fiber of wool is itself already spun, made up of far finer fibers which are locked together just as the fibres themselves are locked in the spun yarn. This ultimate fibre is a long string of atoms linked together by forces of immense strength. If these strings extended throughout the whole length of a hair, the strength of the hair would be far greater than if it were made of steel. When the hair breaks, it is not because these strings are themselves broken, but because they slip past one another. They're not nearly as long as the hair. nature uses two kinds of chain for nearly all her structures. One of them is called cellulose and is the element of construction of all plants, all living things that have their roots in the ground. The other is the protein chain. The backbone of that chain is a single row of carbon and nitrogen atoms, two of the former to one of the latter. The backbone is curiously fashioned in a zigzag shape. All sorts of pendants are attached to the chain, and the wide choice among the pendants is responsible for the variety of the proteins. The chain which makes silk has but a simple selection. It's always well extended, which is the reason why a silk fabric does not stretch. The chains in wool are much more complicated and are normally curled up considerably. They can be uncoiled, especially with the aid of moisture and heat, and can again coil themselves up, which is the reason why woolen materials can be stretched or shrunk. Asbury of Leeds University, who has made many of these observations, remarks that a beautiful illustration of this stretching takes place in the hairdresser's shop, where by extending one side of a hair and not the other, a curl may be given to it, and hence the fashionable permanent waving. Nature makes great use of these protein chains in our own bodies. Spinning therewith are muscles and nerves. A muscle contracts when the chains coil themselves together. One of the most important pendants of the protein chain in hair and horn and nails is a certain assemblage of atoms known as the molecule of cysteine. It contains sulfur, and apparently this acts as a preservative, which is the reason why hair and wool and woven materials do not decay rapidly, like muscle which contains no cysteine. As Asbury has suggested, hair may roughly be described as vulcanized muscle. These discoveries have significance in biological studies, in the attempt to understand the actions of the living body in health and in disease. It is remarkable how in recent years the subjects of physics and chemistry on the one hand, and of biology and life study generally on the other hand, have drawn together, and in doing so have provided opportunities for researches of the greatest interest and importance.